Well, a terrific front-page article in today's New York Times gives a timeline of a two-year collaboration between dissidents in Egypt and their counterparts in Tunisia. But it also draws a line, ultimately, from the street protests in both countries to a former Harvard professor in a cluttered apartment in East Boston, Massachusetts, Gene Sharp. Gene Sharp runs the Albert Einstein Institution. His writings have inspired opposition movements around the world, including in Serbia, where young people helped overthrow Slobodan Milosevic a decade ago. The Times reports that Egypt's April 6th movement modeled its red and white clenched fist logo on Serbia's Optor youth movement symbols. So once again, people are asking, who is Gene Sharp? The last time was two summers ago when hundreds of protesters were tried in Iran, charged with attempting a velvet coup with, quote, the instructions of Gene Sharp. In fact, the government of Iran said 90 of Gene's techniques for resistance were used by Iranian dissidents. We spoke with Gene at his home in a blue-collar neighborhood of East Boston, and when he talks about Iran, it could be Egypt.
Hello.
This is Gene Sharp.
Good morning.
I feel like I've entered a warren of books.
Among the books lining the cramped two-room office that Sharp shares with his assistant, Jamila Rakib, are his. He's written over 33, the most popular, a slim manual called From Dictatorship to Democracy, translated into over 33 languages.
This is Finnish. That's Arabic. This is Ukrainian. That's Tibetan.
I also want to ask about the bumper sticker I see everywhere. Gotov Je with a raised fist. What's that?
Gotov Je.
Oh, that. Gotov Je. Oh, that's from Serbia against Milosevic. Some of their people came to see us after they were successful.
When, in fact, Milosevic was still in power, this sticker started to appear all over the city. He's finished.
Milosevic is finished.
Yes. Yes, he's finished. Yeah. All right, Gene, I've checked the email. I just want to go through a few things that have come in this morning.
Jamila starts every day with a meeting with Gene to go over the emails and letters that pour in from around the world. It's amazing to see just the two of them.
And then I think lastly, Gene's these two requests for translations. So I mentioned Chinese.
Yeah.
Somali.
I can do it.
You've got a lot on your plate right now, don't you?
This is not unusual. We get these inquiries from who knows where.
There's a new article on a Maldivian website. And what they've done is actually put on their website basically all the material that we have available online, From Dictatorship to Democracy, the Anti-Coup, Role of Power.
Oh, look at this. They're directing people to all of Gene's information, Gene's writing. Do you also hear from governments who want to know what's going on there? We want a translation.
You know, it's interesting. Some of our material was ordered from an Iranian ministry that sort of developed to being placed on the list of organizations with which contact is forbidden by Iranian citizens.
By the way, some others who have been placed on this list, thinking of the Berkman Center over at Harvard, some of them have backed away and said, look, we don't want to bring harm to these people, so we're going to cut off on our end too. What about you?
I wouldn't even know how to begin to cut off contact with people. People use aliases. They write to me from an anonymous email address. There was an individual that wrote to us a couple of weeks ago who called himself Jason Bourne. If you,
the
sure
Bourne,
you've seen the Bourne identity. So I was somebody really clever who just, that's the nature of our work.
That could have been someone locked in their apartment in Iran.
That's right.
Now remember, when Gene and I sat down to talk, it was a year ago, and it was about Iran. It still applies, but listen to how eerily it also applies to Egypt. His book lists 198 methods of protest, but says nonviolent struggle can only succeed when enough people have a light bulb go off to power it. I asked him then if he thought there were enough people in Iran for that to happen.
We shall see. We shall see. They've been learning a little bit of what we've been sharing thousands of times, downloading From Dictatorship to Democracy. So there's chances, but they are facing already extreme repression. And as the regime feels more and more threatened, the repression is likely to become more brutal. But you don't bring down a regime solely by street demonstrations. You have to have other parts of cooperation to withdraw the sources of power from the regime.
So you have everything from non-cooperation with government. You can have boycotts of elections, fasting, hunger strikes. I didn't realize
how many different ways there were to say no.
There are more. That's, I think, is a good list. That took me a long time to do. But there are more kinds of means of rejection of a regime than those.
Well, for instance, here's a physical intervention. There's the sit-in, the stand-in, the write-in, the wade-in. Mill-in? What's a mill-in?
You go into an office and just walk around, just walking around.
A pray-in, nonviolent raids, nonviolent invasions, stall-ins, speak-ins, guerrilla theater, reverse strike?
Reverse strike is used in Sicily, where the people were very poor, they had no jobs. The roads needed repair, and the government was doing nothing to repair them, so they organized to go out and repair the roads on their own. And it demonstrated that the work needed to be done, and the government was not doing its job, and was not hiring people, so repair the roads ourselves.
Yeah. Looking at some others, stay-in strikes, you know, stay home, nonviolent land seizures, defiance of blockades, preclusive purchasing?
Instead of refusing to buy something from a certain company, for example, you buy something from the competitor.
Do you see the book in Iran?
We've had reports that people are using many of these methods. In fact, the government has claimed that some 90 of such methods have already been used.
Others have written, too, that you don't want to claim all of that because it's as if somehow it makes it an external thing.
It's very, very important. Their own history teaches them and their own intuitions. In fact, the strange thing about this book, which I didn't plan, is that almost every time it appears in another country, people say, ah, this was written for us.
But when we hear about Iranians being tortured and imprisoned, I mean, maybe they downloaded your writing and went out into the streets and did one of these actions, and then they were tortured.
Yes.
Do you feel responsible?
No. The regime that tortures merits resistance. Resistance comes at a price. A regime that tortures, that finds its power dissolving, is threatened and frightened, and they are going to do terrible things.
Do you warn people of that?
I warn people of that in my writings. If you take this seriously, if you do this, you're likely to meet with repression. You should be aware of that. Don't do it if you're scared. Don't do it if you're timid. Don't do it if you don't really want to risk all kinds of repression.
Former Harvard professor Jean Sharp. When Jean's assistant Jamila Rakib first came to the Institute, she was one of many who confused nonviolence with pacifism.
I thought, perhaps this is another peace outfit dedicated to, you know, give peace a chance. We can't we all be friends? And I thought, well, you know, sometimes resistance is necessary. I've come from Afghanistan, a country experienced more than its fair share of conflict, and I grew up with basically a glorification of the violent resistance, the Mujahideen. You know, over time, I thought that at what cost? Perhaps there was another means that people could have employed to resist the Soviet invasion and everything that came after.
There's an assumption that you either have to be a strong supporter of military means or you're a pacifist, and that's simply not true. This is an approach which one of these scholars studying Gandhi's work in India calls war without violence. It's nonviolent struggle, so it's nonviolent, but it's struggle.
In fact, you prefer to call it political defiance. Why? Because you feel nonviolence sometimes is misinterpreted?
Oh, yes. It's sloppy. It can mean anything and everything, from Mennonite pacifists over to a mass demonstration of millions of people.
Again, we're listening to our conversation with Jean Sharp from last year. Another myth about his organization, that he takes money from the government. We read today about how U.S. aid money played a role in the protests in Egypt, for instance, paying for election monitors to oversee what were widely regarded as corrupt parliamentary elections, under a program pushed by the Bush administration and in particular Liz Cheney. Now, conservatives are upset that some of those funds have been cut under the Obama White House, but even though some bloggers think Jean takes government money, he says he doesn't.
In spite of our very bad financial situation.
I mean, you could use the money. That's no.
You could use the money, but not with the strings and not with the connotation, not with someone else saying how it's going to be used.
For instance, I'm reading Jonathan Mowat. He writes, the Bush administration pushes soft coups. The main handler of these coups on the street side has been the Albert Einstein Institution. Counterpunch, wrote that AEI, Albert Einstein Institution, plays a central role in a new generation of warfare that does the work of empire. So there are people...
Nonsense.
Yeah,
it's absolute nonsense. Some of these people are ideologues, but that's simply not true at all. We are not serving... How can you be making available to masses of people in many languages the knowledge of how to struggle nonviolently, powerfully, and still be a servant of empires? That's utter stupidity.
What is the difference between the work that happens here and, let's say, undercover CIA agents in Iran? How do you see it as different?
We're not trying to tell people what to do. We're often asked by people in different countries, what should we do? And we refuse to tell them, because that's not our business. It's their business to decide what to do. What we can do, if they're interested in doing things, whether it's supporting their government or against their government, if they're interested in doing this nonviolently, then we have the basic knowledge available as to what is this technique of nonviolent struggle and what makes it successful and what makes it fail.
Can you tell us the primary reason why they succeed and fail?
If people are not strong, if they're not ready to participate in a struggle which takes major effort, if they're easily intimidated and frightened, if they don't plan carefully what they're going to do, if there's no strategy, if the struggle is taken over by violence, they're not going to succeed. It's quite simple.
Is war ever necessary? Have you ever seen one?
That's for other people to decide. I make my own decisions, but people will decide if they don't have an effective nonviolent substitute, they will use war. At the beginning, you use these symbolic methods, like picketing or passing out leaflets, walking down the street, having a parade or a march. That won't bring down the government. To bring down an oppressive regime is to pull out the supports from the regime, including the soldiers. People put flowers in the guns of the soldiers and eventually mutinate. It's like a table. If there are termites eating those wooden legs, eventually they get very wobbly and eventually will collapse. And no, you're not going to succeed immediately, but you have to set the thing up in such a way that eventually that's going to happen. At the time when they decide, you don't like this either? You don't like shooting these people either? Why are we wearing these uniforms? Why are we doing this? Then that happens very fast. But it's risky. They can be killed just for doing that. And people do that nevertheless. And it requires a great bravery, just like a violent struggle would require great bravery.
Nothing soft about a soft revolution.
It's very tough, very hard. But that is a process that seems to be going on, but there's no guarantee.
Gene Sharp, one last thing. We're sitting here. Do you ever find yourself wondering, decades of work, millions of people freed, and yet here you are. No one outside knows you're here. You struggle for funds. Do you ever find yourself thinking, what's wrong with this picture?
We could do more with more support. But it's sometimes not always the masses of budgets. I mean, think of all the, is it billions of dollars amassed by NATO and the U.S. military capacity, which had no effect in bringing down communist governments. They were able to liberate themselves, the people.